You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 5th of May 2016 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme... France is fighting back against President Hollande's plans to introduce sweeping labour reforms, but could Parisian protests define his administration? And...
New is great, isn't it? So we're launching a new national newspaper. It's got a new approach, a new outlook, a new style, a new layout, a new mix of opinions. It even feels new. Welcome to the new day.
Well, new is now most definitely old. The UK's first standalone daily in 30 years will close tomorrow after just 9 weeks in circulation. We'll ask whether the newspaper trade is in crisis. Also on the programme... The European Union has had a tough time of late, but could a new musical about the continent's woes help lighten the mood in Brussels and beyond? That's all to come on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome one and all to Midori House. My guests today are the journalists Samira Shackle and Jonathan Fenby, author of an upcoming book on modern France and also managing director of the China team at Trusted Sources. Jonathan and Samira, welcome to you both. Now, could radical plans to overhaul France's labour laws be about to define François Hollande's term in office? The French president wants to loosen rules to make it easier for employers to lay people off and cut costs. But the proposals have been met by violent demonstrations, the sort that haven't been seen since he was elected 4 years ago. Jonathan Fenby, is this a desperate last throw of the dice from a president who, let's face it, is unlikely to get re-elected?
Yes, well, Hollande finds himself once more in a quandary of his own making, largely, because on the one hand, most economists would say that you need to relax France's labour laws, ironically, by making it easier to sack people so that employers will take on people more easily. The problem in France is that employers generally don't employ people because they know they'll be stuck with them if the economy or their business turns down. So Hollande, his Prime Minister Valls, the Economy Minister Macron, launched this labour law, but there's been this huge outcry against it, both popular outcry and within Hollande's own Socialist Party. And his problem is that he needs the support of the Unified Socialist Party, and a lot of those people are out in the streets at the moment, if he's to have any chance in the next presidential election, which is exactly a year off. So he's in this position where he was doing something, but politically he's actually weakening his own base for a presidential rerun.
And Samira, you know, this is an issue that we're seeing across Europe on the left, that when you have either centre-left governments or you have left-wing parties that want to try to move slightly to the centre, the activists within their parties aren't really standing for it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that it's interesting, as Jonathan said, so much of this opposition is coming from within Hollande's own party and a sort of support base that he needs if his own political career is going to continue. And, you know, I mean, that's obviously not the only opposition that's coming to it. I mean, in my understanding, the sort of from right-wing quarters of government, is the sense that it hasn't gone far enough and so on, even though it doesn't sort of, they didn't go any further when in power themselves, as Sarkozy didn't do anything approaching it. But yeah, I think that is true across Europe. I mean, perhaps less so with the French Socialist Party, which is a very long established sort of quite centre-left party. But if you're looking more broadly across Europe, the sort of rise of protest politics, if you will, sort of born out of frustration and anger at these kind of high unemployment figures, stagnating growth across Europe. When that kind of protest politics translates into leadership, it's often met with resistance from within the ranks of its own supporters, because it's very difficult to take that sort of idealism of the protest into the sort of pragmatism of government.
And Jonathan, at the same time, François Hollande is trying to appeal to his more left-wing supporters. He's talking about tax breaks for low-income households. He's promising pay rises to school teachers. Is it possible for him to essentially sort of play both sides in this way?
It's becoming more and more difficult. About a year ago, I wrote some pieces arguing that he had a better chance than the polls showed in the next presidential election. The problem in all this is called Marine Le Pen, and the far-right National Front. She will finish in the first two at the presidential election. The French system is you have a lot of people going in for the first round, and the top two go through to a runoff. And what happened in 2002 was that her father, Jean-Marie Le Pen, got his way into the second round. And of course, at that point, everybody who was a non-National Front person coalesced around Jacques Chirac and elected him.
With the very memorable slogan of, "I'll vote for a thief rather than a fascist."
Yes, better a crook than a fascist. Now, this time, what Hollande's hope is that Marine will indeed finish probably top of the poll, according to the latest opinion surveys there, and that the mainstream right will be so divided, they have at least three candidates, possibly five, running, that he will squeak in as the second person among the top two, and then everybody will coalesce around him as they did around Chirac. His problem is that to do that, he's got to keep his left-wing base solid behind him, and there are a lot of them who aren't very enchanted by him.
And indeed, Samir, on that point, he's in this strange situation now, where, as you say, he's trying to introduce some reforms to improve the economy, but actually if he's got any chance of, first of all, winning the primary of socialist voters to become the candidate in the first place, he needs to appeal to that left-wing base.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, he's also sort of created a bit of a bind for himself, because I believe he's said that he won't stand for re-election unless the unemployment figures come down, and they've been sort of pretty steady at 10%, and I think close to 25% among the youth, which are pretty staggeringly high, and sort of twice the rates in Germany. So he's already said that if he doesn't he sort of pinned his political career to these Labour laws, if as he believes they will make a drastic difference to the unemployment crisis. I think that he's already said he's not going to stand for re-election without that, so he's kind of pinned his flag to the mast there.
Yeah, I mean, one of the interesting things in this is that a lot of people, if you like, on the centre-left in France, would much rather that Manuel Valls, the Prime Minister, ran. He's a much tougher character, he's a better campaigner than Hollande. But it's always been the problem in France, how do you get the king out of the throne so that the Dauphin can take over from him? If he did, and Macron, the economy minister, who's very much a market-minded person, he's just set up his own political movement there. And a lot of people would say that Valls and Macron would have a much better chance than Hollande on his own.
But would they have... They might have a much better chance once the election actually happens. Would they have enough of a chance with socialist voters?
No. But the theory is... I mean, I've spent too many decades... looking at French politics and the innards of French politics. But you can imagine that the centre, if you like, would vote for Valls and Macron there, and that would chip away at Alain Juppé, the former Prime Minister, at Sarkozy, and all the other people on the mainstream right who want to run. And it must be said, Juppé, who's now over 70, and who had this great phrase once that French politicians' political life only ends when he's actually dead and buried, and he's the proof of it. But we remember, 25 years ago, he was the man who'd last introduced serious economic reform in France, and went down to a catastrophic defeat in the next election.
I want to come back onto that point with you in a moment, Jonathan. But firstly, Samira, do you think we're essentially seeing a sort of a fragmentation of politics, not just in France but across Europe, where instead of, for example, finding people voting for a politician that they think is going to have mass appeal, they're voting for people who they believe in, and that therefore means that you might have four or five candidates who all can get somewhere between 12 and 18% of the vote?
Yeah, perhaps. I think there's also across Europe, and probably tied to what you're talking about, sort of quite widespread disillusion with politics as usual. And that probably, I think, empowers the kind of politicians such as Marine Le Pen, people who are appealing to sort of base sense of populism, who don't always have the most sort of thought through policy platforms or sort of records in government and so on, not just in France but across Europe. And I think that there is, obviously it's manifesting very differently in different countries, but I think that there's a sort of a sense that old systems maybe aren't working as well. And as you say, I think that can translate into, for instance, you know, where you could be quite certain that two parties or three parties are going to get the main share of the vote, those sorts of certainties being upset. And it's difficult to know exactly how that's going to pan out over the coming years.
Yeah, I think you've got this across Europe. If you look more broadly, you've got Hollande, the difficulties in France at the moment with continuing high unemployment. Unemployment's actually gone up, although growth is slightly better. You've got Angela Merkel, no longer the kind of leadership figure that she seemed to be a year ago. You've got Italy with a huge banking crisis about to break. You haven't got a governmental majority in Spain or Portugal. You've got the European-minded Dutch voting against the Ukraine agreement. You've got Greece. You've got refugees. You've got terrorism. You've got Poland going back into the 18th century and so on. This is not a very happy continent.
You're painting a very happy picture for us.
But I'm not saying Brexit as a result.
Okay. John, I want to come back to something that both of you sort of touched upon, which is the issue that we started with here, which is France's labour laws and the state of its economy. You mentioned Alain Juppé more than two decades ago bringing in reforms or trying to bring in reforms and then being rewarded by being booted out of office. We've had Jacques Chirac two terms as president. We've had Nicolas Sarkozy for one term. Now, granted, at some stage there have been socialist prime ministers underneath those centre-right presidents. But this is a fundamental problem that French politicians full stop have failed to deal with, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, this is the theme of my new book on France, going back to the revolution, that the French like to think of themselves as progressives, as Chirac once said, a beacon for humanity. But when push comes to shove, their leaders nearly always pull back from the brink. They don't take the hard choices. The one exception to that was obviously Charles de Gaulle in 58, who founded a republic, refounded the economy, did all kinds of things. For me, the villain in this is actually François Mitterrand in the early 80s, who was elected on this kind of dreamy platform. Everything was going to be absolutely wonderful, and it fell to bits within 2 years with disastrous results, including high unemployment, which have continued ever since. And his successors act as though they're actually afraid of a rerun of 1789. You know, the people may come out and take them to the guillotine.
Okay. Well, we look forward to your book on that subject as well. Let's move on now. The UK's first standalone newspaper for 30 years will close tomorrow, just 9 weeks after it was launched to much fanfare.
New is great, isn't it? So we're launching a new national newspaper. It's got a new approach, a new outlook, a new style, a new layout, a new mix of opinions. It even feels new. Welcome to the new day.
There we are. That advert, I must say, didn't exactly fill me with joy, Samira Shackle, when it first came out. What went wrong with this newspaper?
I mean, I think there's lots of things. I think that you can talk about the sort of logistical things that, for instance, I think the paper had a very, very practical level and much earlier print deadline than others, so that cut it out of putting things which do attract people to a new paper, like sports results and so on.
And news that's just happened.
Exactly, yeah. There's also the fact that I think that it did only last 2 months, so that's not really enough time to establish a readership by any means. I think if you're being generous, you could argue that it might have built up a following had it had longer to run for. There's the fact that the cover price kept changing, which is confusing. It was free for a day, then it was 25p, then it was 50p, then it was 25p again briefly, then 50p again, I think. And so that confuses people. And there's also, it sort of set out as something that was planning to upset the current trend and buck the trajectory of things going online only. They didn't have a website, which is quite a bold decision in 2016,
yes.
I think.
Good use of the word bold there.
Yeah. In 2016. So no website, no positioning, I think, as well. They said that it was going to be non-partisan and features-led, and which is a nice idea, I think, but actually the whole pitch of getting people who don't like newspapers to read newspapers is something that I think needs a lot of investment if it's going to work, because it's a nice idea in principle, in the same way that it's a nice idea to get people who've never voted before out to the polls, but it's in practice both things are very, very difficult to
achieve. You can't base a strategy on either of those things.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And I think you need if you are going to do that, you need serious investment in marketing and so on, which doesn't seem to have been there.
Jonathan Fenby, you've been involved in the launch of a newspaper. This one was a little different from the one that you were involved in.
Yes, well, I was at the Independent when it launched, and of course it just closed after 30 years of life. And, well, several things are absolutely true that have just been said there. That, I mean, first of all, the Independent, you know, people say, ah, it arrived like a great new gift to the newspaper reading public. In fact, it took 6 months for it really to bed down The Economist. And there were some moments during those first months when we were certainly a bit worried. And also the Independent, I think to launch a publication, A, it's got to be good and it's got to offer something new, which I think the Independent did back then in lots of different ways. But also you've got to be either very lucky or very cunning with the market that you're dealing with. I mean, at that time, there was a demand for the kind of newspaper The Independent was, because the Times was stuck, as its editor said, its only job was to get Thatcher re-elected. The Telegraph was, you know, read by retired army officers off in the shires, and The Guardian was wandering off into some kind of world of its own. So there was a place there for The Independent, indeed. Now, that is still the case, actually. Strangely enough, that may be the case again here in terms of print, but without an online presence, without something demonstrably new to offer, I don't think you can make it. And this paper, this new paper, in a sense, it was too nice. You know, it was too ordinary. So what's special about that?
Well, that's one of the things that struck me when they said that, well, our research shows that people want good news. They want positive stories. Oh. People always say that, but they're lying. They're lying.
There was an American editor who once I was involved in lots of debates about this bad news, you know, negative news and so on, way back when. And at a conference, an American editor made one of the best statements. He said, well, you'll all have listened to me today. And if you go home tonight, you'll say to your husband and wife, oh, you know, how's the day? All right. Won't mention this conference. If I die of a heart attack here, the first thing you will say when you go through the door is, guess what happened? This guy died.
Samira, you know, are we looking at this the wrong way of going, oh God, the newspaper industry is in crisis? Because, look, of course the newspaper industry is in crisis. It's been in crisis for probably about 15 years when there was a massive, you know, advertising slump even before 9/11. But when you look at the news producing industry, if we can put it in that way, there are all sorts of different news outlets which exist now, which didn't exist 10 years ago, and are thriving. They're just online.
Yeah, I agree, actually. And I think that the sort of traditional models are struggling, and obviously if you work in the media, particularly the print media, it's something that sort of debate and discussion is something you're exposed to all the time. And I think things like, even The New Day wasn't a long established paper, but any closure, I think, is something that sort of shakes up the industry, particularly The Independent and so on. But I would totally agree, actually, that while it is very sad to see sort of big titans of in the British media landscape struggling, there are sort of beacons of hope, and all sorts of new models are emerging. We're not entirely clear like what's gonna work. But as a young writer, for instance, I think there are so many outlets for your writing, and it's a very, very good quality. I think it's very easy to dismiss lots of these new media outlets as sort of producing primarily lists and pictures of cats. But actually, there's some really high quality sort of journalism coming out of the kind of long form or narrative type things, or sort of heavily reported pieces that you just maybe don't have space for in lots of traditional papers anymore, or they don't have the resources for. And so I think that we're in a transitional phase, but I don't think the outlook's entirely bleak, and there's certainly an appetite for this stuff. There's no doubt about that.
Jonathan, when we look more broadly across the world, you know, it's a slightly different picture elsewhere. You've got, in France, for example, an industry which is sort of struggling. I remember a few years back, Nicolas Sarkozy promising every 18-year-old a subscription to a newspaper for a year, which was ill-fated, but quite a nice gesture. But you go to Germany, and if you go to a cafe in Berlin, everyone's reading a newspaper. They're not on their phones. They're reading newspapers. You go to Japan, everyone's still reading newspapers.
Well, but I think it is true that, you know, that new information is still very strong and is there. The question has been for newspapers, for me, and I speak as a crusty old journalist who was in when all these debates were being discussed first in the 80s and early 90s. The problem is that most newspapers have applied a newspaper mindset to their online activities, and an awful lot of people who know how to do things online aren't particularly interested in the old-fashioned newspaper definition of news. It's just material. It's information there. And I have very few people actually have made the bridge between the two.
Okay, we'll leave it there. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Coming up in just a few minutes. Theatreland's very best would struggle to make a decent musical about the travails of the European Union, but Italian broadcasters are giving it a pretty good go. We'll have more on that after this.
It's the show presented by me, Andrew Tuck, all about the cities we live in. The show that celebrates urban living, from tough-talking mayors and civic activists to the guy who runs a perfect neighbourhood shop and the woman who, come sunset, turns into a gorilla gardener. The Urbanist is the go-to show for anyone who wants to know what makes a great city, and also a rubbish one, and how good lighting or wise technology could shape their metropolis for the better. Join us every week for sparkling debate, global reports, and some agenda-setting interviews.
We have a chance to shape what the urban environment will be like for billions of people.
The show premieres live every Thursday, or you can subscribe to the programme as a podcast at monocle.com or on SoundCloud or iTunes. The Urbanist, the programme that knows its good mayors from its planning nightmares.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me in studio, Jonathan Fenby and Samira Shackle. The leader of Bangladesh's largest Islamist party lost his final appeal today against a death sentence handed to him for his role in the country's war of independence from Pakistan. Motiur Rahman Nizami was convicted of appalling crimes, but his defence team and human rights campaigners say that his conviction is unsafe and that he is being executed to settle old scores. Samira Shackle, are they right?
I think there's definitely major big questions to be asked about the procedure of the War Crimes Tribunal. It's been incredibly controversial since it started in 2010. I mean, apart from the four people who've been sentenced to death thus far, scores of people have died in associated protests and violence. And Human Rights Watch, international human rights organisations, have questioned the practices of the tribunal and said that it's not up to international legal standards. So I think that there is some justification to the claims that there's an element of score settling here. So the ruling party, Sheikh Hasina, the prime minister, says that it's very that it's a necessary process for the country to have a sort of have a reckoning with its past and with the horrendous crimes committed during the 1971 War of Independence, which is an incredibly bloody war. But I think it's about the sort of manner in which it's been carried out is less of a reckoning with the past and more of a reopening of old wounds. And it's really sort of, you can see the ripples of it sort of across Bangladesh. It's really having a huge effect, bringing out sort of old divisions and conflicts really to the forefront.
Jonathan Fenby, it's a problem that many nations that have had, a difficult birth face, isn't it? Of how do you deal with terrible acts that have been committed, and how do you balance up peace and justice? Because often the two don't necessarily go together very well.
Absolutely not. And you know, you've had some cases where people have attempted to do this. You had in South Africa the council there, reconciliation, and so on, and in the Balkans to an extent. But it is very difficult, this question, obviously, of do you expose the crimes of the past and so on and so on at the risk of destabilizing the present regime? And that, of course, would be something that autocratic rulers would keep very much in mind. But it may also apply more generally. And I think, you know, I'm no expert on Bangladesh, but the whole background there, and if you go back to the foundation of Pakistan in 1947, I'm just writing about it at the moment by coincidence, and it came to me almost as a surprise or as a revelation, the extent of the seeds of present problems which were laid back in 47 and have been maturing or germinating or festering or whatever you like for 65 years.
And Samira, when we look at Bangladesh's present day problems, many of them can be traced back to what happened in 1971 and the moments after then.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, Bangladesh at the moment is most often in the headlines for the spate of very violent murders, initially against secularists and now sort of broadening out. And those can very directly be tied to the war crimes tribunal. So the first murders that we saw of this manner in 2013 were very directly related to tensions over the war crimes tribunal. Secularists began to be targeted in this very brutal way with machete attacks by groups of men. In relation to their support for the war crimes tribunal and particularly for death sentences for the Islamist politicians who are on trial. So it was that kind of, it's that level of heightened tension that's sort of precipitating not just protests and counter-protests, but a sort of wave of militant violence that's now sort of spiralling out of control and isn't being taken care of by the government, who in turn are blaming that sort of violence on the opposition parties who they are currently pursuing through the war crimes tribunal. So you can really see that it's not just something that's happening in the halls of politics, it's ricocheting throughout society, and it's making those lines between Islamist and secularist, which were sort of in a very sort of crude manner, it's a simplification, but still the lines along which the 1971 War of Independence was fought to an extent, those dividing lines of Bangladeshi society are really coming out now, and it's having quite brutal consequences for the people.
Okay, we'll move on to our final item of the day. A musical about the history of the European Union might seem a bit of a stretch, even for the best writers on Broadway or indeed London's West End, but that hasn't stopped Italian broadcasters from having a good go. Europe, What a Passion, the musical tale of a stormy love affair, gets its premiere tonight. And if you don't speak Italian, fear not. There are plans to roll it out across some of Europe's finest cities in a number of languages. Jonathan Fenby, this is what the campaigners for Britain to stay in Europe were waiting for, wasn't it? A musical. If this is played across Britain, then we'll surely stay.
Absolutely, and I'm expecting a starring role with my fine countertenor voice in this one and my nifty tap dancing. I don't know, it sounds like a jolly idea, which I don't think will go all that far. Mind you, I mean, what's the big hit on Broadway at the moment? It's a musical about Alexander Hamilton, the first US Treasury Secretary, and you wouldn't expect that to have been the greatest of subjects. So perhaps, you know, we'll have Juncker, we'll have the European Commission all strutting their stuff before long to persuade the Brits that, yes, we must stay in.
It would be quite a sight. I guess, Samira, when you think about all the elements that need to go into a musical, you need, you don't need bureaucracy, obviously, and you don't need sort of boring cities. But anyway, but aside from that, you know, you do need a bit of argument, you know, and you have that in Europe. You want a little bit of passion and sort of will they, won't they, which we have with Britain, sort of in and out in the 70s and now here. So you could sort of see how this might work.
Kind of. I'm just wondering who the love affair is between. I don't know if you're going to have sort of the countries represented as you would in a Greek tragedy or a sort of medieval mystery play, representative characters of Britain, France and Germany playing out an interpersonal drama, or is it going to be sort of torrid focus on the lives of bureaucrats?
Who knows? I think, well, yeah, a torrid focus on the lives of bureaucrats, I don't quite know. But I mean, Jonathan, you could say, you know, the love affair really is between France and Germany.
You could have Merkel and Hollande doing a nice, you know, pas de deux and so on and so on. But it's really those late night sessions, I think, in the Berlaymont building in Brussels, you know, as they stop the clock and endless coffee and sandwiches. I think they'll find something there.
I'm sure they will. Samira, obviously, this won't help at all when it comes to those who are campaigning for Britain to stay in the EU. But there has been this debate, hasn't there, within that campaign about how much the argument should just be about dry economics and, well, you'll definitely be safer and better off if you stay in. And the idea of some sort of a positive story and what it means to be European.
Yeah, this definitely won't help, I don't think. But I think that's an interesting point. And I think that actually on the voting record of the British public in referenda past, I think that the fear vote's probably going to be quite powerful. I mean, I think there's often, the public is often quite small C conservative and votes against sort of major change if you look at recent history. So I think that that's certainly a going to be a powerful part of it. But it will be interesting to see if anyone does try to make the positive case, because the counter-arguments are so emotional. Just more sort of, well, let's not let them tell us what to do.
Well, that's something, you know, somebody born, I hesitate to say how long ago, during the Second World War and so on. And, you know, just purely the fact that there hasn't been a war in Europe since 1945. The fact that we've all got relative more prosperous, some obviously more than others, the opening up obviously to Eastern Europe, all those kind of things for me are a cause of an emotional commitment to Europe, but the emotion's all on the other side.
Absolutely.
But you know, if we set that to music, who knows? Jonathan Fenby,
I'll go home and start writing
Jonathan
it.
Fenby, please do. And Samira Shackle, thank you both very much indeed. That's it for today's edition of Midori House. It was produced by Rhys James, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Maria Granina. The studio manager was Toby Hammond. We've got music, then it's The Urbanist with Tom Edwards, then it's The Michael Daly a little later. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thanks for listening. Goodbye. Meet the right.